devoted to Schubert. That's 2 weeks of Schubert. Personally speaking, I can't wait.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a perfectly normal production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Linda Jones.
Sally Beamish was a busy and successful viola player until, about 20 years ago, three things happened to her. She became a mother, she moved from London to Scotland, and someone stole her viola. That triple whammy changed her life completely, from being a performer to a composer, writing, I think, some of the most inventive and engaging music around, music which tells stories.
To put together a choice of music and find different themes that run through my music, and it kind of gave me an overview of everything that's happened to me since I started composing when I was 4 years old.
Join me, Donald MacLeod, for Sally Beamish as Composer of the Week, weekdays this week at 12 noon and 6:30 on BBC Radio 3.
1 hour today, it's a minute past 12 noon and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The artist Tacita Dean has gained an international reputation for her original and idiosyncratic work, especially that using 16mm film. As anyone, in fact, who has visited the Turbine Hall at Tate Modern recently will be all too aware. Indeed, the show's on for a few more days. Tacita, I'm very fascinated by the way time has interested you and the gradual disappearance of things which in many ways you want to preserve, especially in the realm of film. Where does that come from, that love, do you think?
Well, I think time is very connected to the medium of film, which is one of the things I talk about when I try to say that they are different. You know, the two mediums are different, film and digital are different, because the language of film is all about time. You have to think about time from the very beginning, because of course you only have a limited amount of time to use, and editing is about time as well. Personally, I think that my films are imbued with the film time to some extent, but in terms of seeking out things that disappear, I don't tend to seek them out. It seems to happen anyway. It's like, so maybe I'm attracted to them just by chance, or, you know, I filmed a Palace de République and it got knocked down afterwards, and obviously when I film some people, then they die. I mean, there is a connection between the subject and the disappearance of that subject.
Presumably with something like 16mm film, one is fighting a kind of battle against an industry, because even the editing machines, Steenbecks and things like that, get more and more rare, and the stock presumably gets more rare.
Well, I mean, the Turbine Hall installation is actually 35mm, which is the first time I've ever used that. Right now, it's really critical. And there are a lot of people that are very, very concerned about it. For some mysterious reason, to me, as an artist who loves mediums, you know, I can make an oil painting if I want to, and I can make a 16mm film. I can even make a CD if I want to. I'm allowing myself all that choice, but for some reason, the film industry is blind to giving themselves the choice of both mediums, and that's a mystery to me. And somehow, if they could get that into their mindset, that now they have two mediums instead of one, and that they should keep both, because there are things film can do that digital can't. And there's, of course, things digital can do that film can't.
What things particularly that film can do you feel make it worth saving?
Well, how you make a film is very different from how you make a digital work. So, you know, it's about things that you make or you do in the moment, which you do on film, which, I mean, digital relies very heavily on post-production. So the whole mentality of how you make a film and a digital work is very different. But, of course, everyone talks mainly about the quality of the film, the fact that it's light on emulsion. You get mistakes, of course. And, you know, anyone who's worked with any medium needs mistakes. Mistakes are very beautiful. You don't get mistakes digitally anymore, and it shows. You know, things like flare and, you know, overexposure and underexposure, all these things you can sort of copy digitally, but you can't get them in quite the same way. And it just makes for a whole different qualitative.
And do you like the tactile thing of actually handling?
Well, I really like that. Yeah. So I still cut my film as film. Mm. So that's actually the real crisis for me, that I will lose the ability to cut film and work alone as I do on my Steenbeck, you know, not unlike a painter or a sculptor or any of the other, you know, professions. I mean, that's what I really will miss. And it's the printing of film that's so endangered with the digital projection.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask you, bearing in mind that this programme is essentially about music, whether you have the same feeling about analogue sound as opposed to digital, because a lot of people do, actually.
Well, I have to say, my sound has been digital for a while, but I still cut my sound with magnetic tape. I mean, 16mm mag, so I completely understand the resonance of it and the air in analogue sound.
Because I heard, for example, one of those recordings that were made with a wooden needle of somebody singing literally into his master's voice receptor. And there is a quality you get, which I can't really put my finger on it, but then the human voice comes back through that wood going round in a groove. There is something even more realistic than you can get on a digital microphone.
Well, I should say I live in a completely analogue household. I mean, my other half, as it were, Matthew Hale, he has the most enormous record collection, and we only listen to records in Berlin.
What role has music played in your life?
When you invited me to come and do this, I got quite stressed about it, because then I realised I'm a bit of a dilettante with music and I'm no expert. And, you know, I would record things from Radio 3, which wouldn't have heads or ends. And I'm kind of chaotic in relation to music, but still quite impassioned about it. It's not like it's an absence. I'm just not an expert. I'm more emotional than intellectual about it, actually.
But music has obviously cropped up in your life quite a lot ever since you were a child, not least because you had a musical neighbour.
Alfred Deller. Well, Alfred Deller was an enormous personality in our childhood because my mother loved him so much. And I mean, his son, Mark Deller, is still somebody who we see often, and he sang at my father's funeral. And my brother was at school with, well, I was at school with Tom Deller. So we have those generations of Dellers that we've grown up with. But it was always the music that my mother was playing in the house. So I have this incredible fondness for him.
So what would you like to recall him with?
Well, I chose this piece from Purcell called Sound the Trumpet, because it's got Mark and Alfred singing together, father and son. And, I mean, I love the piece of music anyway, but it's that kind of the pair of them singing together.
And they interweave, don't they?
Yes.
Thank you. They do actually manage to get a kind of trumpet attack in the way they sing, don't you think?
Yes, I love that. It's full of exuberance.
And were you fascinated too, as so many people are, by the fact that these were males who were making this sound, which has a feminine quality?
No, because, I mean, I grew up listening to that and never knew other in a way. So it's always been what Alfred and Mark make, the noise they make. So
Alfred and Mark Deller with members of the Deller consort, sounding Purcell's trumpet. Tacitus, when you have film in your hands, I mean, I noticed, for example, in the show at the Tate, how important, in a sense, the actual, I can't remember the technical word for
it, the
gates, the sprockets, yes, how important they are. I mean, cause, and they also are units of time in a way, aren't they? Mm.
Well, what I should say about film in the turbine hall is that the sprockets are, of course, part of the image. It's just an illusion.
How do you put them on?
Well, nobody's. I mean, that's unfortunately the miracle of the manufacture of film, as in the film that I made, is lost on a digital generation because it was almost impossible to do that. But I did it through masking in the aperture gate. So I developed a way of making an aperture mask for a camera that had the little sprockets like a stencil. So it's just stenciling them onto the image through the photographic process. And everything in the film was made that way. So, you know, just even sort of colouring the various parts of the east wall of the turbine hall was done through masking. So the film went through the camera sometimes up to 12 times. But, of course, it's an invisible process. You're imprinting something, rewinding it, because, of course, only when it's finally exposed and printed, you actually see what you've done. So, of course, it allows for all sorts of things to go wrong. And some of the mistakes are actually in the final film.
I was interested, too, because as a musician, it was like having something which people do use in digital technology, but which you wouldn't use. But it was like having a kind of visual click track going on. In other words, one was being given a unit of time almost visually.
Film has a great parallel to length because, you know, I'm always counting frames. You haven't have a tape measure on the edge of your Steenbeck and you can measure like 24 frames is 1 second. And I actually cut my film because when the Steenbeck turns, when the roll turns, it has a sort of click, click, click. And I find, I mean, people accuse me of being, you know, enjoying longer or whatever. What they mean is boredom, you know, slightly boring. But I kind of cut my film to the click. It's a sort of time that is impossible to quantify, but it's a sort of time that happens just by accident. But I find I'm listening to the whirl of the spool as it loops up the film, and that's how I cut the film or create time in these moments. So it's a sort of esoteric process, I guess.
One often has a piece that kind of has accompanied one throughout life for some reason and is a kind of signature tune to one's existence. And with you, it's the Allegri, isn't it?
Mm. Well, I was first played it by a school friend when we were like teenagers. And then I noticed that my mother had the sort of Roy Goodman singing the single, which of course stops and then you turn it over for the second side. So it interrupts it actually, which I think is quite interesting.
Well, I can see how you would, because that also fits in with what you do in your work, doesn't it, to a certain extent?
Yes, and it's also the same, funnily enough, when I was trying to find pieces of music that had been important to me, I just remembered when they cut out on the cassette. And it's so weird to actually hear the bit continue because that sort of forms your way of hearing it.
I mean, it's a bit like, isn't it? And there's something that I find often very exciting is when you see incomplete sketches of something and they often tend out to be more powerful than the final image, which gets rather laden.
I totally agree with you. And I'm very much attracted to that. And also accidental things and, you know, like, or drawing by default or anything like that, absolutely.
And that happens in music, you know, because when one's composing, quite often something slips through. Well, very often when one hears it on the orchestra or something, one will say, oh gosh, that was wrong. But just in case you think, yes, that was wrong, but it's wonderful.
Well, that's happened a lot with my films, actually, when you know, you have to lock it so it remains in sync. And if you forget to lock it, then it goes out of sync, tragically. And then suddenly, and before you know it, you've played it out of sync. You think, my God, that's actually better.
Well, perhaps we should hear it as Allegri hoped to hear it first. The Miserere, which has got that wonderful high treble soprano solo, hasn't it?
Yes. I mean, I like it because my friend Mark Wallinger used it for a work.
Threshold to the Kingdom. A very telling work, actually.
Yes, no.
Let's describe it, because that's at the other Tate at the moment.
And yes, and it fills all the galleries wherever you are. It follows you around the...
And basically, he's done it, the visual image is of people arriving at the city airport. And somehow, the busyness of what they're doing and the calm peace of this music create attention of their own.
It's
slowed
down.
It's incredibly effective.
Yes, it's beautiful work. He's a great artist.
Thank you.
quite interesting, the combination of a Gregorian plain chant, which is so simple and spare, and then there are the more rich harmonic verse, chorus, if you like, that comes after each line. And I wondered whether you'd ever seen Tacitus Dean notation, Gregorian plain chant, notated.
No, I haven't.
You should look at it. I think it would interest you because the notes are little square blocks and they're put next to... They're like little sprockets, actually, like your sprockets, anyway, in your film. But they're put, instead of being always one after the other, they're like building bricks on top of each other. And there's a way, when you know how to read the music, you know if you go down or up. And I think you might find it quite interesting as a something which has not been lost and is worth preserving. We heard the choir of King's College, Cambridge, conducted by Sir David Wilcox in the Allegri Miserere, and the treble soloist effortlessly rising to those high notes was Roy Goodman. It's strange how music sometimes comes to one by chance. I mean, listening to that piece, did it take you to various places?
Well, I was listening to it. I was thinking that perhaps it would probably make my brother cry, because I think the last time I heard it, apart from in the Tate Britain when I was wandering around and hearing it from Mark's piece, was in a National Health Hospital in Ashford when my father was dying and in this terrible men's ward, actually, and they'd put Classic FM on, which was playing the whole time. It was Christmas. And then this came on, and we all... It was with my whole family were there. We just fell silent, and it was like this kind of incredible moment where we were all just transfixed in the moment. And I think my brother said he could never hear it again. So, maybe we'll see what happens.
You talked about Classic FM happening to have been on at that moment, but that serendipitous thing also, in one way, led you to our next music, because it was through a play that you got interested in this music.
Well, I think I was living in Canterbury. I can't remember. I think it was, I must have been either still at school or on foundation course, but I went to with my mother to see this play called Masterclass. And it was basically a cast of four, and it was Shostakovich, Prokofiev, Stalin, and Stalin's chief of police. And it was all about the persecution of these two great composers and the insistence, if I remember, of Stalin on his pedestrian taste being imprinted upon these. And all I can remember was that my mother and I found it incredibly funny, and we were laughing so much. We were practically the only people in this entire audience that were rolling about in tears of love. I mean, it was really strange. No one else seemed to be laughing. That's what I can remember. And after that, I did go and seek out both Prokofiev and Shostakovich, particularly this one record that my mother had already had, which was both of them, their cello sonatas.
So this was the Shostakovich that imprinted itself.
Yes.
Thank you. Stephen Islis playing there with Olli Mustonen, very dynamic playing. The second movement from the Sonata No. 4 for cello and piano in D minor, Opus 40, by Shostakovich. Do you actually like to use music when you're working with film yourself, Tacita Dean?
I don't use music in my films, actually. I use wild sound, but it's still a fiction, and I create my soundtracks.
From found sound?
Well, from found sound, yeah. So, I mean, it's incredible how I will put in a dog barking or a sort of far-off motorcycle. It's incredible how sound is...
So you're a composer in a way?
Well, I work with this sound designer called James Harrison, who I think is a bit of a star. Because, of course, you have to keep sound immensely simple, and some people have got to pack it in there. But, of course, that's why the fiction of sound is more pared down than actual sound. So if you record sound, you hear a lot more than you do when you actually create a sound.
You did use our next music, albeit at one remove, didn't you?
Well, I think I learned a lot by the next piece called Sonatine by Ravel, which was the only piece of music, composed music, I've ever used for a film. And it was my post-undergraduate film called The Story of Beard. And funny, as you were saying earlier, because this one always sounds too fast to me, because the friend who played it, who was called Phil Jones, played it much more slowly than any recording I could find since. But I was living in a house in Brixton, and it was a composer's house, Tim Hodgkinson's house, and there was a garden outside, and there was a window open in his little music room, and I recorded the piano. I can't remember what we were doing in the garden, but there was a whole group of us, because you can hear everyone laughing on the thing. And then there was aeroplanes and ice cream, and we were recording this piece of music. And because I was a student, there was no way I could put layers of sound on it. So it was just a single piece of magnetic tape was the whole soundtrack. And I think it taught me a lot about sound, actually.
So the music was deliberately second-hand, if you like, if not third-hand.
It was deliberately second-hand. I recorded it from the garden. So you had the bird song.
And it was actually coming from...
It was being played in the window, not unlike this situation, actually.
But we're not going to recreate that effect here, because we're going to hear the music played by Robert Casadesus, the first movement from Ravel's Sonatine.
Thank you.
The first movement of Ravel's Sonatine, played by Robert Casadesus. Tacitadine, your next choice is a piece of film music.
Mm. When I first hear this music, I get goosebumps because I love this film so much, and it's Providence by Alain René. And the music is so enmeshed in the film and so beautifully on a level with the film. But this is a film that it was the only film that he made in English. Well, up until that point, I don't know if he's done any since. And it's got this kind of cast of five. It's got John Gielgud and Dirk Bogart and David Warner. Wonderful actors, all of them. And Elaine Stritch and Ellen Burstein. And I just think it's one of the best films ever made. You can't get it on DVD. I don't know why. The script is probably one of the best film scripts ever written by David Mercer. I just think it's a wonderful film. And what I love about it is it does all these things that if I ever was to make a longer, more narrative film that I would love to play with. You know, he just plays with location. You're driving down a street and you're in Limoges and the next day you're in San Francisco. You know, not day, in next moment. You know, he looks out one side of the street and you're in France. And he looks out the other side and it's obviously not France anymore. So you're very disorientated and it plays with all sorts of genres. It's a wonderful film.
Générique from the original soundtrack of the film Providence, composed by Miklos Rozsa. Tacitadine, we were talking about the serendipitous nature of coming across things, but sometimes that serendipity sort of feeds itself into your own work, I guess. And that's true to a certain extent with the Janáček, because it actually found a kind of a mirror, if you like, in the work you got interested in doing at that time.
I remember hearing a documentary about Janáček and about how he'd written what is known as intimate letters as a much older man falling in love with this woman.
Camilla Stoeslova.
Which was never requited, I don't think. Well,
No, it wasn't.
So she was very much a muse. But at that time, I remember seeing Cy Twombly's exhibition in the Venice Biennale. And that was also full of this sort of newfound exuberance. I mean, I became very fascinated by old age and possibly particularly old men and this sort of exuberance and the knowledge and information they have in themselves and their physicality as well. And I at about the time that I started to listen to Janáček, I also began filming, well, what people call my portrait films. But I mean, I don't put them in such a category because they all come from different places. They're all, you know, genesis for the ideas and are not in any way the same for each case.
And did you find that you found quite different things in each one?
Oh, totally. I mean, it began with Mario Mertz, who was an Art of Povera artist. And he was in San Gimignano. His wife was Marisa Mertz, is also an artist. And she had been selected for the same exhibition that I was in. And we were supposed to make a work from the place. And I just studied him. And he had a sort of a resemblance, what I thought he had a resemblance to my own father. So I was staring at him in this way. And I remember saying, asking people, do you think I can just film Mario? And everyone said, no, no, you can't. Don't ask. And then I remember giving him, he loved ice cream, so I bought him Frutto da Bosca ice cream and then said to him, Mario, can I film you? And he said, yes, but no speaking. So I turned my DAT recorder so the mic was pointing up to the trees. And then he spoke, of course, the whole way through. So then I had the sound of cicada really, really strongly, just tss, 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 much louder than him, which, of course, in the end, he was a pontificator. But for me, he just became sculptural, which was very interesting in a way. He chose how he wanted to be
so depicted. Really, in a way, accidentally, on purpose, as it were, you got again a fractured sound, as you did with the Ravel. I mean, you got actually a distorted balance.
Yes.
And that's what interests you, really, isn't it?
I kind of welcome things like that. For example, I'm a lousy camera person. I can't do it at all. And it was one of those Italian days that went from sort of dark cloud to bright sunlight. And I totally underexposed the film. So sometimes he's completely black and then there's just a tiny bit of his grey hair showing. It's one of my favourite films that I've made, weirdly, because it's so of that moment, that place, and it's sort of, you know, in a way, it's not perfect, it's flawed. I am, I suppose, interested in flaws.
This music has, I wouldn't talk about it in terms of flaws, but it has a kind of earthiness in terms of its emotional directness.
Well, I used to call it wrongly so because a sort of dotage. I love the idea of dotage, but you know, where you're sort of blind to your own inhibitions and you can just get on with it because nothing matters anymore. And there's something of that in this Janáček, and it made me listen to a lot more of him, actually.
Thank you. There's a lot of turbulence in that music.
It's wonderful.
The first movement from the String Quartet No. 2 by Janáček, played by the Smetana Quartet in a Prague concert in the Dvořák Hall. Tacita Dean, we started by talking about your work in the Turbine Hall. And curiously enough, we're going to end with something which was prompted slightly by the admiration of this artist for your espousal of 16mm film, not to mention your admiration for him.
Well, I've been a Neil Young fan from a teenager, so that he should actually sit down and write for the book, which is accompanies the Turbine Hall work, I can't tell you how excited I was when I got an email from him. He even sent two to correct slight tiny things in the last sentence. And it just more than anything made me realise that if Neil Young should sit down and write for some artist in London, how much he cares and how much so many people actually care about losing their way of making things. And I think the true anguish is with the makers. He doesn't make just sound, he also makes films. But I mean, I was so delighted when Neil Young wrote for the book. You know, and he was nearly the last. Scorsese was the last, but it was nearly the last. And it's like, yes, if we have Neil Young, we've got to be able to convince the world to keep both. Because all it is a plea to keep both mediums. It's not like saying we want to go back in time. That's a misunderstanding, totally. For some reason, the film industry is so absolute. They think they have to have one and get rid of the other. It's crazy.
What music of his would you like to have?
Hurricane.
Like a Hurricane, Neil Young in concert. Tacita Dean, we've mentioned all kinds of things, but there are so many others that we could mention. I was thinking of your work with Merce Cunningham, the influence of John Cage, perhaps. And I was very pleased to see that we shared a mutual passion, which is John Craxton.
Oh, really, yes.
Yeah. A wonderful painter, I think.
Yes.
It's funny how fashion decrees, I mean, not that he's not, but, for example, somebody like Lucian Foyd is a great painter, and it's quite hard to get to see Craxton's these days. I mean, there was a room at the Tate Britain recently, but it's the way of the world, I guess.
Well, I think, actually, he's coming slightly more back in fashion. So, yeah, things go in and out, but he kind of isolated himself to some extent. I think he took himself out of England, you know, moved to Crete during his working life, therefore didn't probably make himself so visible. But yes, I mean, I have a sentimental attachment to him because I met him when I was, you know, he was important to me as a young potential artist or young artist. And just to see a real artist, meet a real artist. I met him when we were on a family holiday when I was about 17. And
in Hanya.
In Hanya, exactly.
What are you working on at the moment?
Well, the turbine hall drained me to such an extent I've had to do a lot of catch-up with other things. But I'm working on another film, which is actually related to J.G. Ballard, who's another person that I've always had great respect for. And that's going to be filmed in America.
Tacita Dean, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tacita Dean was talking to Michael Barclay. There's no edition of Private Passions next Sunday, but in 2 weeks' time, Michael's guest will be the actor Trevor Peacock, one of the stars of The Vicar of Dibley. And the reason why there's no Private Passions next weekend is this.
From Cornwall to the Shetlands, it's the beginning of an amazing year of music making on the BBC.
Music Nation, a whole weekend of music making.
Go online to bbc.co.uk/musicnation to find your local event or listen.
Starting Friday the 2nd of March at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Hello, I'm John Shea, and this Sunday afternoon on BBC Radio 3 continues in a couple of minutes with Baroque music from Poland. That's in today's Early Music Show. Right now, at just after 1 o'clock, it's time for the latest BBC News, read by David Cornett.
The Syrian government is holding a national referendum on a new constitution as violence continues across the country. Opposition groups have dismissed the vote, organised by President Bashar al-Assad, as a farce and have called for a boycott. The city of Homs has come under fresh bombardment, with activist groups saying that at least 26 people have been killed so far today. The International Development Secretary, Andrew Mitchell, has warned that people trying to escape from Homs are being put in further danger by infiltrators posing as humanitarian workers with the Syrian Red Crescent organisation. Two wounded Western journalists remain trapped in the city. The wife of the Sunday Times photographer, Paul Conroy, has called on the British Embassy to forget the protocol and get him out. An Afghan police security officer is being hunted on suspicion of killing two American military advisers at the Interior Ministry in Kabul yesterday. The man, who's 25, fled after the shootings. His relatives in the city have been detained. The Afghan president, Hamid Karzai, has appeared on national television to appeal for calm following violent demonstrations over the burning of copies of the Quran at a US military base. 30 people have been killed and hundreds have been injured since the protests began 5 days ago. Nelson Mandela has been discharged from hospital after undergoing a surgical procedure yesterday for abdominal pain. The former president, who's 93, had a laparoscopy where tiny cameras are inserted through small incisions. Scotland's First Minister, Alex Salmond, has refused to confirm that he's chosen a date to hold a referendum on Scottish independence. The Scottish edition of The Sun on Sunday reported that plans were in place to hold the vote on Saturday the 18th of October in 2014. And the weather, many places will be dry and mild with sunny spells, but it'll be cloudier in northwestern parts with intermittent rain. More persistent rain and strengthening winds will reach the northwestern half of the UK by this evening. BBC News and weather at approaching 3 minutes past one.
From David Cornett.
Music by Berlioz features in our Sunday concert in an hour's time, a single work, his dramatic symphony Romeo and Juliet. It's a period instrument performance by the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, conducted by Sir Mark Elder. That's our Sunday concert at 2 o'clock. Before that, here on BBC Radio 3, the Early Music Show. And today, the second of two programmes this weekend exploring music from Poland. Lucy Skeeping makes some discoveries from the 17th century Baroque.
Welcome to the show. The chances are you may not be all that familiar with the repertoire we're going to hear in this programme. The Baroque masters of, say, Germany and Italy are certainly well known these days, but the opportunity to hear the music of some of their counterparts in 17th and early 18th century Poland is relatively rare. The music we're going to hear was all recorded at St John Smith Square in London. Highlights from a concert in the Lufthansa Festival given by the Retrospect Ensemble. Six singers, strings and a couple of trumpeters directed from the keyboard by Matthew Halls. And as well as items from that concert, I'm delighted to be joined by Adrian Thomas, an authority on the music of Poland, who's going to guide us through this still little known repertoire. But let's start with some music. A short instrumental piece by Adam Jarzembski, a composer who worked for the Elector of Brandenburg in Berlin, visited Italy and spent the rest of his life as a member of the Royal Chapel in Warsaw. This is his Canzon Quinta. The Retrospect Ensemble with Canzon Quinta, a five-part string piece from the Polish Baroque composer Adam Jarzembski, and we'll be hearing another of his pieces later on. Well, with me is Adrian Thomas, who's going to help guide us through some of the music we're hearing. Now, the word Baroque is Italian, of course, so what did the Baroque mean to Poland musically?
I think one has to fill in a little bit about the historical background to what's going on in Poland in the 17th and 18th century before one can actually get to the music. It was centred around Kraków right through the Renaissance period. Kraków was the capital, it was the trade centre, it was where the Jagiellonian University was founded, etc. And the golden age of Polish music, for many people, is the 16th century, particularly the second half of the 16th century. So when we come to the turn at 1600, Like many other countries, they were in a state of flux, but in Poland in particular, their method of government and therefore of patronage also was changing. The centre moved from Kraków to Warsaw. The king went to Warsaw. His royal orchestra went to Warsaw. He employed Italian musicians specially for his new centre in Warsaw. So with that in mind, if we think what Baroque might mean for the Poles, it means shifts, it means changes of context, it means courts and chapels having an increased role in sponsoring and having their own court orchestras, their own chapels, if you wish. The Baroque was an exploration of a new world. It went in tandem with what was going on in Central Europe, particularly in Germany, but also with Italy.
Were things as sophisticated, though, in Poland as other parts of Europe? I mean, did Polish music travel?
It certainly was sophisticated because a number of composers went abroad. And, for example, Zieleński, whom we're going to hear in a moment, went to Italy. Jarzembski, whom we heard at the beginning, he also went abroad. And so, of course, they brought back the music that they heard and influenced what they were writing at home. It's not quite so easy to say that Polish music then travelled back abroad. I mean, this has been a centuries-long problem for the Poles, and it happened in the 19th century, it happened in the 20th century. We don't know very much about Polish music because the sheet music is virtually unobtainable in this country. CDs are virtually unobtainable in this country. Concerts like the one we're listening to today are rather rare. So throughout Polish history, there's been a sort of isolationist aspect to its culture, which we're still fighting against.
Now, you mentioned a moment ago Mikołaj Zieleński. What do we know about him?
We know relatively little. And this, I'm afraid, is this is quite typical of quite a few composers of this period. What we do know was that he was an organist and he directed the chapel of the Primate of Poland at a place called Wawicz, which is in the centre of Poland. And the Primate during that time was a man called Wojciech Baranowski. He was a great music lover. And he actually funded the publication in Venice in 1611 of Zieleński's Offertoria and Communiones. So it's reasonable to assume that he studied in Italy, that he knew the music of Palestrina.